third lecture, continuing our sort of walk about a few of the types of science that we do underground. So last time, we spent quite a bit of time discussing the different types of backgrounds that come into play in underground experiments, and basically the tools and techniques that we use to understand, mitigate, and characterize those types of backgrounds, because once we have those tools in place, we can make stronger analyses. And so we can make our experiments more sensitive by understanding and mitigating those kinds of backgrounds. And I also mentioned that, so today we would do a tour of some different types of dark matter detectors and detection techniques that are used around the world, all in underground labs. And so clearly the backgrounds techniques that I talked about, you know, apply to dark matter, but in addition, they also apply to any kind of rare event search that you might do, including neutrinoless double beta decay. And so tomorrow we'll do a really sort of a one-day overview of neutrinoless double beta decay and sort of some of the motivation behind that science. So we spent the last like 10 or 15 minutes of class yesterday where I outlined the Dahmer-Lieber experiment, explained to you how it works, and talked about their result and their excess. And then we talked about possible interpretations and sort of the pitfalls that all of those interpretations basically have. And so right now, Dahmer-Lieber is a bit of a mystery. And so that has motivated scientists to try, it's kind of basically a worldwide effort to test the Dahmer-Lieber experiment, to try to understand what it is they're exactly seeing. And the reason that we have to go and build experiments to try to do this is, I think someone had asked about this, is so they don't have open data like some of the other experiments have. And so it's not that anybody else outside of the collaboration can go into their data and try to understand it or try to come up with their own hypotheses. You're always just left with what's in the publication and trying to work with what's there. And so when you don't have that data, then your only other option is essentially to try to build another experiment to replicate it. And I had started talking a little bit about some of the challenges that people had in replicating their experiment in a cost-effective way. And part of that was growing and having crystals of sodium iodide available that had the purity requirements you would need in order to have the same sensitivity that Dahmer-Lieber has. Yes?
Do you know why their data isn't public?
Because they decided that they don't want it public. I mean, the collaboration, they have no requirement to release the data. There's no government agency or anything that is requiring them to have an open data set. And so it's their collaboration's choice to not share the data. I don't know the reasons beyond just that they don't. That people have asked for it. People in the scientific community would like to be able to see their data and to be able to try to use it to understand what's going on. But for whatever reason, the collaboration doesn't share. So I think you're just, if you want to do something with Dahmer-Lieber, you're left with going through their publications and, you know, coming up with some clever program to take the data off their plots and use it that way, or whatever information you can glean from their papers. Yeah. Sorry, I don't have a better answer. All right, so that said, you know, there was this host of experiments. So the last slide I actually had shown yesterday to show that there's this effort. And so I'm gonna just highlight two different collaborations that have recently put out results for Dahmer-Lieber. So, are trying to test Dahmer-Lieber. So these are setups similar to Dahmer-Lieber that are going on worldwide. The first one that came out with results a few years ago was a COSINE 100 experiment. This is a merger of essentially the DM ICE collaboration and the KIMS experiment. They're located in the Yangyang Laboratory in South Korea. They have 8 copper encapsulated sodium tellurium crystals. So they have 106 kilograms total target. They use two 3-inch PMTs to read out each crystal. They trigger at a threshold of about 2 photoelectrons. Calibration is done through tubes that kind of go close to the detector, so you kind of put your calibration source on a wire, and then you would feed it in through a tube and pull it back out. Their total background is essentially 2 to 4 times higher than the Dama Libra average. So they're seeing in their crystals 2.7, and this here CPD stands for counts per days, per kilogram per KEV, on average in the 2 to 6 KEV region of interest. Their uranium, thorium, and potassium is below Dama, and the lead-210 contamination that they have is very close. And one advantage is that they've been able to get very high light yield out of their detectors. And so this is just a bunch of different characteristics about the detectors that if you were an experimentalist who was really thinking about the backgrounds and the nitty-gritty and trying to compare what they have to what it is that Dama Libra has, these are the sorts of numbers that you would be interested in knowing about. So they did this modulation search on 1.7 years of data. So that, so years of data doesn't really tell you a whole lot all the time when it comes to some of this. So it's an important aspect. Really what matters is sort of what your exposure is. So it's your mass times time. And so that's 97.7 kilogram years. They did a global fit using cosmogenic and the sinusoidal components simultaneously for all crystals. So I don't have that formula up here, but you remember when we were talking about what a signal from an annual modulation would look like? It had a sinusoidal, it was a sinusoidal function that depended on multiple parameters. They excluded 3 of the crystals from the analysis because they had low light yield and a lot of PMT noise, so that made them not really suited for doing this type of analysis. The sideband events that they had, so a sideband would be looking at areas outside of your region of interest. So here, this is sort of like, would be like your region of, I guess this is a calibration run, sorry, the region of interest that they had. So they're just showing I only have the bin up here that is, but you would look at bins that are greater than 6 KeV and bins that are lower than 2 KeV, that would be your sidebands. They agree very well with known the cosmogenic components. So just some plots there. And so what did they find? They came up with a result that is consistent both with the null hypothesis and and also with the Dama Libra result. So the best fit that they had in this 2 to 6 KeV region was had an amplitude of 0.0092 counts per day per kilogram per KeV, and the phase of that of their modulation was 127.2 days. So that's consistent with both the Dama Libra's best fit value. And so kind of looking on this plot here, this is the amplitude versus the phase. And so this is sort of where Dama Libra is, or I'm sorry, this is the result, so their best fit, this black dot. The blue dot is the Dama Libra's best fit for amplitude and phase. And then these different bands here are kind of giving you bands for, like if you had sort of 3 sigma, 4 sigma, or 5 sigma, you know, sort of where do you fall here? So they would expect 3 sigma coverage of the Dama region within 5 years of data exposure. Sorry, I see your question there. I'll just finish the statement and then we can get to it. So what that means is that since this was essentially done on, you know, just shy of 2 years, it's 3 more years before you can probably say anything more conclusively about whether or not they agree. Yes?
Does the Dama phase measurement agree with what you'd get from the standard Halo model?
I think it fits pretty well. I mean, so essentially remember, so the phase is really going to be about the Earth going around the sun, right? generally speaking, as you're moving through. So you're expecting kind of a peak and, you know, in a low point, and pretty much you would expect that, roughly speaking, that you would have the peak once a year and the valley once a year. And so, you know, a phase around 127 days, you know, a phase in here is pretty reasonable. And so let me make a caveat there, because I realized, so if it was that you were, like, your instrument was perfect, and it was perfectly, like, we would say absolutely it's the standard Halo model and there's no other funny business going on, which is probably not a great assumption to make, but it, you know, but it's a starting point. Your phase for that modulation would be here on this green dotted line. So you can see Dhamma is actually closer to that hypothesis than what cosine is. But I don't think, I mean, it's not statistically significant, right? The error here is 46 days. So if you add that on here, you know, that kind of puts you anywhere in here, if you're thinking about it that way. So, so cosine has errors, Dhamma has errors. So you can see that there's a consistency, you know, for that hypothesis. Similarly, if you look at the amplitude, they're both pretty aligned. Any other questions? But that's a great question. All right. So the other experiment these results came out shortly after the cosine results was from the ANIS experiment. It's located in Hall B at the Cam Franck Laboratory. They also were using sodium iodide crystals. Their crystals were each 12.5 kilograms. So they had a total of 112.5 kilograms of sodium iodide crystals in sort of 3x3 modules, and you can array in these modules, so you can kind of see pictures of this here, you know, read out by photomultiplier tubes again. So they had a three-year sort of background model that they were putting together. So they had three independent background modeling procedures to try to really characterize this background. So one of those backgrounds was the exponentially decaying background. The second model that they had used a probability distribution function that was derived from a background model. And then the third background modeling procedure they did was a probability distribution for every detector. And this was in order to take account of systematic effects. So it really is, oftentimes when you're building these sort of they're not monolithic, they're more modular or granular detectors. Each detector can have sort of its own characteristics. So you saw that when we were looking at the cosine data, how each crystal had slightly different, had some slightly different characteristics to it. And so that's sort of what this third model is about, dealing with the systematics due to that. And so this is sort of their results. And again, the data support the absence of the modulation in both energy regions and in the three background models. And their best fits are incompatible with Dhamma Libra at sort of 3.3 sigma. If you're in the 1 to 6 kV region, and in the 2 to 6 kV region, it's sort of a 2.6 sigma. So neither of these are not really strong results to say, you know, definitely Dhamma Libra is not right. So you can see here, so this is the way that they have looked at it. They looked at the modulation amplitude, and so that's what you're seeing here, not the phase. And so essentially, this is like, essentially if you have zero residual and you were consistent with your background, and then you sort of have the 1 sigma, the 2 sigma in yellow, and then the 3 sigma in blue for that 3-year exposure. And so you can see in all of these cases, you're still kind of looking at a 3 sigma exclusion-ish, 3-ish. So that's where we stand. And again, what do you need to do is just get more statistics. So it's just running these detectors longer and being patient.
Is is the definition of that amplitude, are they kind of marginalizing over the phase or something?
Oh, I mean, this is the amplitude. So you would, this is the amplitude of the modulation, the deviation from zero, right? Or like, so it's a residual. Like, so you have some background model, and if you're perfectly fit to the background, you'd have zero amplitude.
I see.
And if you were, you know, and if you then, you know, over the course of a number of years, you get your modulation. So I see what you're saying by an average. Do they average, like, because the modulate up and down could,
have negative values. That just means that they're undershooting the maximum. If they were to find something that was significantly negative, that's a loud part of the parameter range.
All right, so that's really all I have to say, and all of the clarity I can bring to what's going on with Tama Libra, unfortunately, at this point. It's what the data tells us. So the next step, the next step there is you either can continue to think about possible explanations of things they forgot and then, you know, write papers with limited amounts of data, or you just continue to wait for the effort to do an experiment and get a long enough exposure to say anything catches up. All right, so next I want to move on to the liquid noble experiments. So if you're going to do a liquid noble dark matter experiment, it's a very popular technique. You know, essentially, these are monolithic detectors read out with PMTs. And they have been, a very hot topic for detector development in the last few decades. There are sort of three noble liquids that are considered or have been considered for dark matter detectors: xenon, argon, and neon. So neon is actually really not considered so much anymore for dark matter detectors. Like, it's such a light element, and you need so much of it in order to make it work, that xenon and argon have ended up being the dominant elements that are being used. But the properties that you have of these different noble liquids determine a lot of the practical aspects of any experiment that you might create. So the example I have here is that, you know, xenon has a very high density and a large target mass, so you can make a large target mass. But the drawback is this is not very abundant in the atmosphere, and that makes it more expensive. Essentially, in liquid nobles, you have the energy loss of any kind of particle that you have gets divided between excitation, ionization, and the sub-excitation of electrons that end up becoming liberated in the ionization process. So the average energy loss in ionization is slightly larger than the ionization potential or gap energy, if you will, because there are multiple ionization processes that are going on. And so that means that the ratio of something called the W value right here, this is the average energy required to produce an electron ion pair. If you compare the ratio of that value to the ionization potential, you generally end up getting something that equals sort of 1.6 to 1.7. So I decided to skip the slide that walks through all the chemical processes that go on to produce a scintillation signal. But essentially, you can get a couple of different types of signals out of this process. But what it is that you actually measure in the end is generally the way these works is that you would have a large tank filled with your liquid noble, and then you would instrument it with PMTs, typically on the bottom and on the top of the detector. So when your particle comes in, it interacts initially in this bulk, and it immediately produces scintillation, and it produces electrons. So you get the photons from scintillation and these initial electrons. These electrons in a two-phase detector. So a two-phase detector typically will have a gaseous region at the top. So what they do is they run an electric field across the entire detector so that after you have this first interaction, there's an electric field. So the electrons will drift up into the gaseous region where the photons will just immediately not be affected by the electric field and you know, hit your PMTs. And so when the electrons hit this sort of gaseous phase, there's a second scintillation process that goes on. And so you get a second hit of light from it. And so what you do is you measure both the first scintillation and the second scintillation energy. And when you look at the ratios of something that interacts with a nucleus, what you'll find is that the ratio of S1 to S2 is different. It's smaller than in a gamma or an electron. So a gamma will interact with the electron. So an electron recalling event, you get a greater amount of S2 as compared to S1. So the ratio changes. And so this is kind of cool. So you can use that ratio in order to tell you about the physics of whether or not you have an electron interaction or nucleus or an interaction with a nucleus. You can use the drift time to indicate, to calculate what the Z axis is for the interaction point. I mean, with some errors, obviously. And you can use the location of the hits of the PMTs to do kind of an XY reconstruction. So you get a little bit of information from these detectors about where in the volume the event initiated. And so we already kind of looked at some of these plots, but this is basically the three different xenon detectors that are running in the world right now that are doing two-phase. So you have the xenon N-ton. This is actually from Lux. I probably should have updated this with an LZ plot, but LZ would have something similar to this. And this is from Panda X, which is a Chinese experiment. And in each case, what you're seeing in the top box is you're seeing radon calibration. So this would be your calibration for an electron recoil in all three of these top boxes. The middle box is your calibration run using a neutron source. So this is to characterize what a nuclear recoil would look like. And then in the bottom box here, what you're seeing is you're seeing actual dark matter search data as being published. So this is just to kind of give you a little bit of an idea of how you're doing. And so you can see, for example, here in the xenon one-ton experiment, this blue solid line here is the median energy from the electron calibration. So the electron recoiling calibration with some error bars. I don't know, they're probably 2 or 3 sigma error bars, probably 3 sigma. And then this is the median distribution of your nuclear recoil with your error bars. And so you can see how the separation should happen. And you can see that in this particular dark matter run, all of their data points really kind of lined up more with that blue line, indicating that most of those events were likely coming from electron recoils. And so you could do the same thing with these two plots here. So this is just kind of illustrating the discrimination power of this type of detector to discriminate electron recoils from nuclear recoils. So there are some things to take into account when you're thinking about these types of detectors. So if you're taking these like photoelectrons that you're collecting in your PMTs and you're trying to convert that into energy, there's actually information that you need to be able to do that. And so so I'm gonna throw up a few formulas that show you how it is you go from what you're measuring, the scintillation that you're measuring and your calibration sort of sources to actually getting the energy of your nuclear recoil. So nuclear recoil events are measured through a combination of scintillation light, so S1, the observed scintillation light, and ionization. Ly is a light yield. That's photoelectrons per keV. L effective is the scintillation efficiency of a nuclear recoil in liquid xenon or liquid argon or whatever your liquid would be. And then SE over SR is the suppression of the scintillation signal from the electric field for both electric recoil events and nuclear recoil events. And so this L effective here is actually something I should probably explain a little bit further. So this is essentially accounting for the quenching of the scintillation signal for a nuclear recoil. So remember we talked a little bit about quenching, I think, two lectures ago. So this is like S1 of the nuclear recoil divided by the energy of the nuclear recoil. The S1 is measured from a 122 keV gamma line using a cobalt 57 source divided by 122 keV EE. So it's kind of a ratio that you're taking there. The nuclear recoil is related to the S2 signal by the S2 signal that you observe divided by Y, which is a secondary amplification factor, and also then divided by Q sub Y, which is the number of free electrons that you would have per unit energy. And so I didn't put the reference here, but Elena Aprielli and her colleagues have a paper that really talks about all of this if you're interested in knowing more ever. So briefly, kind of just giving you the status of the TPC program in the world. So currently you have Xenon NTUN that's taking data, and I believe is going to take data until 2025, and it's an 8-ton liquid xenon experiment. You have the LZ program, which started taking data in 2021, and I believe is going to be going to 2025. It's a 7-ton liquid xenon experiment. And then there is currently Panda 4-ton, which I believe is running, but I don't have information about how long they're planning to run that data, that detector. It uses 4 tons of liquid xenon. So under construction in Gran Sasso is a 50-ton liquid argon experiment called Darkside. They anticipate beginning their running in 2026. And then if you go into the future, this should not say taking data. So if you're going in the future, these are I would call these more in the concept stage, concept and design stage. You have the Darwin 50-ton liquid xenon detector and the XLZD 50-ton liquid xenon detector. And these two collaborations are talking to each other about perhaps combining and just being one, you know, sort of one experiment. Or maybe a consortium with two experiments. I don't know. I mean, they're in talks. Yes.
So if I'm not mistaken, Dama Libra is also in Gran Sasso.
It is. Gran Sasso has a lot of experiments in it.
Are they affiliated with Darkside 20K?
Gran Sasso does provide support and researchers who work on Darkside 20K. So they are a collaborator on Darkside 20K. Ironically, Snow Lab has also researchers who work on Darkside 20K. So I should actually have added in here, there's another experiment that is basically a consortium of all the, I mean, it would be the dark side people plus like Deep plus a number of these that are going, that has ambitions to do something like third generation dark matter, something of this size and sensitivity using argon. And I think that they're calling their experiment Argus, and they're a consortium of the different experiments called, it's like GADMC, yeah. Global Argon Dark Matter Consortium, GADMC. So there is that consortium too. So I probably should have put them in this box as well. But they're really a concept. Like I'm not, Like I would really have to dig to think about what size. I forget what size they say they want to be, but their first step is to get dark side running before, you know, being able to really plan something going much further. All right, the next one is bubble chambers. So you guys have been talking with Ken Clark quite a bit, who I guess is doing a good substitute for Darren Grant, is what I've heard. He would be the expert to tell you all the nitty-gritty about bubble chambers, because he's one of the world experts in this technology and working on these types of dark matter detectors. And so the first thing is, like, I think it's helpful to review a little bit how it is that a bubble chamber works. So this is a picture of one of these bubble chamber experiments with an actual bubble in it. And this is my cartoon of a bubble in a bubble chamber. And so what you do is you start with a bubble that's in thermal and chemical equilibrium. So the temperature of the surrounding liquid is equal to the temperature of the bubble. So if the pressure of the bubble is greater than the pressure of the liquid, the bubble will expand in the most simplest terms. So that's not assuming no surface tension, you know, everything is just perfect and equal. So in reality, that's being a little bit simplistic. So you would really want to add the pressure or that is due to surface tension. And so that's an inward pressure. And so if it really is that the bubble will grow when the pressure of the bubble is greater than the pressure of the liquid plus the pressure of the surface tension, which in this case is just 2 sigma over R. There's also a second condition that has to be met in order for the bubble to grow. And that is that the radius of the bubble has to be bigger than a critical radius. And that critical radius that it needs to be bigger in order for it to grow is essentially 2 sigma over the pressure of the bubble minus the pressure of the liquid. Bubbles that don't meet that criteria collapse. So so that's my bubble growing and what conditions it needs. But what does it take for a bubble to even nucleate, to even start in the first case? So the threshold for nucleation has a term that depends upon the surface energy. It has a term that depends on the bulk energy, and it has a term that depends on reversible work. And so, I mean, this is really all the physics that there is behind, you know, forming a bubble and growing a bubble in a bubble chamber. And so I alluded to this last time that there's this really, that these are really nice detectors because you can tune them to be sensitive to certain types of events and insensitive to different types of events.
If you go back one slide, aren't these two criteria the same? The pressure on the bubble and the radius?
And the...
So the two components on the right-hand side. Right.
Yeah. They're certainly related to each other. Yeah.
If you just divide by.
Yes. Yeah. I see what you're saying. Divide by R. Sorry, I have to do all the math in my head. Quite likely. So I guess I should say, and that implies that your radius has to be bigger than a critical radius. All right, so this is really, the really awesome part about this is the detector response. So taking a look here, so if we remember, I think it was 2 lectures ago when I was talking about discrimination, or maybe it was the last lecture, you have, I showed you sort of that plot where you could tune your bubble chamber. This is another way of looking at that same plot. So on this axis here, you have the detector response. And this axis here, you have the energy threshold, and which is, of course, also related to temperature. And so this is for superheated C4F10. And essentially, what you're looking at here, each of these lines is actual data, whether it comes from a calibration source actually, they all come from calibration source. So this is a calibration source that gave off 1.75 MeV X-rays. And so here is sort of what you can see, the detector response as a function of temperature. And temperature, of course, is related to the pressure in the bubble. And then you can see what you have for some of your other things. So alpha particles, nuclear recoils, neutrons, and what your response would be for a 50 GeV dark matter candidate. So you can see here that you can actually get really, so neutrons, nuclear recoils, dark matter, these are all signal-like things. You just want to keep your neutrons away from the detector. But over here, your gamma rays, these are your dominant background. So this is really great, like, because to mitigate your neutrons, you use shielding, you go deep underground to help reduce any of the neutrons you might get from cosmic rays. So this is really fantastic, like, because, I mean, the reason you even would want have to go to, I'm starting to confuse the situation by trying to throw too many concepts at once. So this is really a great technology, but you could say, what about the alphas? So alphas are particles that would, essentially what happens is that radon will plate out onto the glass of the vessel, both the interior, exterior surface. And then radon decays quite quickly to lead-210, which has a half-life of 22 and a half years. So it's a long time. When lead-210 decays, it goes through a series of decays, emitting some betas and stuff to stable lead to polonium-206. And when polonium-206 decays to lead-206, which is stable, it gives off a 5.3 MeV alpha. All of the things from lead-210 downward, you know, happen pretty quickly. You could potentially wait for, but once that radon plates out onto your glass and you have that exposure of having lead-210 particles on your surface, you're kind of screwed. So yes, so these alpha particles are problematic for many detectors, not just this type. Yes.
And since you're underground, you have to worry about radon all the time.
Yeah, I mean radon. So there, that's where you're. Okay, so and primarily it's the interior surface you're worried about. So once you have it sealed up, it's usually fine. But this is why underground and at Snow Lab, for the most sensitive experiments, so Super CDMS that's going in now, we have actually a radon clean room. So a room where the air going into it is scrubbed to reduce the level of radon so that when you're working on the sensitive interior parts of the detectors, they don't get bombarded. Things like the jar and stuff, like if you can protect them. I mean, alphas don't penetrate, you know, very far. So you can shield like the surface and stuff. So the idea is what you would do typically is you bring the detector or the piece of material that you're worried about and you would clean it. Like you would etch it in some way and you'd usually use like an acid type of etch and there's actually a whole, I won't go into the details to bore you, but there's actually a whole like process and research that's been done into how it is that you actually do this acid etching, because if you do it improperly, you can actually have the polonium daughters re-implant on it and you can make things worse. So there are like experts in the world about doing this type of stuff. A lot of them exist at Pacific Northwest National Laboratories, which was a lab in the US built to clean up after, essentially our atomic bomb program. So they're used to radioactivity, but now they do they have really great techniques for detecting even trace amounts of radiation. And like, similarly, you look at, use some of these techniques for like nuclear nonproliferation, you know, all of that sort of stuff they're into. So that's sort of how it works. So it's like you either, once it's cleaned, you start protecting it. And you can use things like a purge gas that would be very clean. So you might store it in a purge cabinet, where you overpressure the cabinet with nitrogen gas, which tends to be very, very low in radon. So yes, protect it. But even when you're doing the best you can, you still end up with something there. It's never going to be perfect.
Sorry.
Oh, and yeah.
What's the detection response here? Like, what are we quantifying under vertical axis?
The detector response, so this would be forming a bubble.
So Is the scale?
I mean, just generic. This is a generic, you know, like scale, yeah, detector response. It's a, yeah, just so think of it as a.
So you just like a puzzle, hit something into.
Yeah, and you would for sure get it, you know, you definitely get a bubble form, right? So you get a bubble, and then if you had a detector response of zero, you get no bubble. So one means you form a bubble, zero means you don't form a bubble, and in between, like, so this is like you took a lot of events and you statistically normalized it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so what about these alphas? So it turns out that alphas deposit their energy over sort of tens of nanometers or tens of microns, where something like a nuclear recoil will deposit their energy over tens of nanometers. And so alpha particles, what this means is that alpha particles are four times louder than a nuclear recoil. So something you would get from like a neutron hitting your detector or dark matter. And so what you can do is you can use piezoelectric sensors in order to listen to the bubble. And so this is just data showing sort of alpha events. And here, and this would be, or sorry, these would be your, yeah, these are alpha events that come, you know, from their WIMP search. But these here are your neutron events that are really recoils. And so, yeah, so you can see there is this difference. And so again, kind of this is the noise, this is what you would see in your readout from, say, a neutron versus an alpha by one of these piezoelectric sensors. So they have a way that you can discriminate against those alpha backgrounds. If they hadn't been able to come up with something, it would really limit the reach of their experiment and their program. So this program's actually been around for a while. It started actually as two different experiments. There was the Picasso experiment, which actually used, rather than a liquid, it used actually like a superheated gel, but the concepts are basically the same. And the Kuh experiment, which were bubble chambers, they came together, formed the PICO collaboration, and since then they have done a number of experiments. There was a PICO 2 liter that was sort of a proof of the concept that it could be done. Then they upgraded to make a PICO 60. When they did that, they found out that it turns out that having that they kind of built the bubble chamber upside down, that if they would, they needed essentially to turn it right side up in order to make it. This caused some backgrounds and problems. And so now PICO 40 liter is currently running at in Sudbury, in Sudbury, so in the Snow Lab. And PICO 500 is an experiment that is going through its sort of final technical design phases and technical design review. And so procurement is being done, and we're getting ready to start construction on that as soon as all the reviews are passed. So I would imagine construction on PICO will start by the end of the year. And I just wanted to say, my movies don't work, but these are movies of PICO and their bubbles forming. And so they began regular operations in February. Another technology. And this is actually the technology that I worked on for a very long time, are cryogenic solid state detectors. So the idea here, and I'm just gonna, yeah, okay. So the idea here is that you essentially deposit some energy to measure heat in a crystal or measure the vibrational or the phonon energy. And so there are two families of sensors that can detect phonon energy or phonon signals in a crystal, both thermal and athermal. Athermal, so thermal sense, the difference between the two is a thermal sensor waits for the full thermalization of the phonons within the bulk of the detector and the sensor itself, where an athermal sensor detects sort of these fast non-equilibrium phonons that are reaching the detector. So essentially in this case, These are like little thermometers that are on an absorber that have a weak thermal link to some sort of refrigerator. So a temperature increase is equal to the amount of energy that's deposited over the heat capacity of the system. And so you can see that there, energy over heat capacity. Also, it depends on sort of a time constant. That is, so this tau is, again, the heat capacity of the absorber and the thermal conductance of the link between your absorber and your reservoir, which here is a refrigerator. The two widely used technologies for measuring out phonons or measuring this heat are germanium, doped germanium sensors called NTDs, and transition edge sensors or TESs. So an NTD is basically a small germanium semiconductor crystal that has been exposed to a neutron source. And so it essentially makes a large controlled density of impurities. The NTD measures these small temperature variations, again, relative to some kind of T-naught, which would be like your refrigerator or your heat sink. And it's set, the NTD is set to be on the transition between the superconducting and non-superconducting regime. And so you continuously read out the resistance by flowing a current through the sensor and measuring the voltage. And then these little NTD sensors, you essentially just take it and glue it to your detector. A transition edge sensor works in a little bit different way. In this case, you would have a particle or something that would come in and interact in your germanium or silicon or whatever your crystal, your absorber is. You would produce phonons that would then travel up into an aluminum collection fin. So the collection fin, this aluminum, is also superconducting, which means that the electrons are kind of joined together as Cooper pairs. But when you add that extra phonon energy into the fin, you're adding energy, so you break the Cooper pairs, and you sort of have these quasi-particles that then go across and go into a transition edge sensor. It's a thin superconducting film that operates near its critical temperature. And so essentially, when you dump energy into the TES, you're, again, moving it from superconducting to not superconducting regime, and you can essentially measure, using something like a squid, you can measure your energy and this temperature change. So those are the two types of sensors that people use to read out phonons. So getting into the experiments, which might be a little bit more exciting for you. So Super CDMS at Snow Lab, they have two different types of detectors. The initial payload is going to be four towers. Each tower has six detectors. There will be a combination of both germanium and silicon crystals, each of them 100 nanometers in diameter and 33.3 millimeters thick, so it makes them a little bit bigger than a hockey puck. Two of the detector towers will operate in something called a high voltage mode, and two of them will be operating in an IZIP mode. The high voltage detectors are the ones that will give the greatest reach to lower mass dark matter particles, where the IZIP detectors will primarily be used to characterize the backgrounds in the detectors. So just to show you how these detectors sort of look, this is an IZIP detector. And so what you see here, the little blue are the phonon sensors. And then these red lines in between are the ionization sensors, so the ionization or charge electrodes. And so the charge sensors act as the ground. The phonon sensors act as the ground to the charge sensors. So on one side of the crystal, you have a positive charge, so positive to ground, and the other side you have the negative ionization. So if I blow up one of these regions a little bit here, what you'll see, these are the phonon sensors or a schematic of them. And if I kind of blow up one of these, this is what it would look like. And so these are the aluminum collecting fins. And these blue, the blue lines here, so these blue little kind of rectangular areas, those are the phonon sensors. So if I, you know, blow this up one more time, this is your TES, so this is your thermometer. In iZip mode, you really get this, a very good sense, you get really good discrimination. So this is the ionization yield. So this is the the charge energy divided by the phonon energy. Or do I have that backwards? Gosh, my mind is going blank. Anyway, this is the ratio of your charge energy to your phonon energy versus your recoil energy. So this is measured by your phonons. And so what you end up with is, this is calibration data that you're looking at. And so what you're seeing here, up here, these events in blue, these are all electrons. These are all electron recoils that are happening in the bulk of the crystal. Down here, these events are actually electron recoils that are happening where the ionization energy is collected only on one side of the crystal, or the majority of it on one side of the crystal. So these are surface events. And so what you can see is that when an electron, or a beta particle, is interacting near the surface of a super CDMS detector, you get this reduced charge, which can leak down into sort of your ionization band and cause a background. But this charge symmetry cut really helps take care of that. Down here, these are the alpha particles. And so I guess basically what you can see is that all of our surface and ER background events, really above a few keV, are easily removed by selection criteria. And these alpha events are really only very large here because we have an alpha source on one face of this crystal, because we really wanted to understand what the probability of having an alpha fake a dark matter interaction was. And so we actually literally took one of our detectors, and when we deployed it, we deployed an alpha source on top of it so that we could make this plot. So I didn't want you to be afraid that this is what we normally expect. We normally would see nothing. This was like us trying to overkill. All right, so the HV detectors are perhaps a little bit more interesting. Essentially, you have your WIMP interaction come in, you get your prompt phonons, and what you do is we normally run the iZip detectors under a fairly low voltage of only 3 or 4 electron volts, depending on whether it's a silicon crystal or germanium crystal. But in this case, we crank up the electric field so that when this happens, you get your prompt phonons, and then as the phonons are drifting through the electric field, they create even more phonons. So these are the NTL photons, or phonons, if you would like. So basically, the idea here is that your total phonon energy is your primary recoil energy, or your prompt phonons, plus the energy that you're getting from these Luke phonons, that you're collecting from the Luke phonons. And so the reason that you would want to crank up the voltage and you would want to create more phonons and collect more phonons is that you can get much better resolution if you're collecting more phonons from the events. And so that's what you're kind of seeing in this picture here. So this is the energy in keV from 0 to 12 and the rate per day for one of these high voltage detectors. And so you can see here that we can see like the L shell and K shell electrons. So if you're looking for dark matter that interacts, say, with an electron or a nuclear recoil, anything, right, you can really get very good resolution on the energy of those detectors. And so I promised you I was going to say something about units again and these funny units. So let's just talk a little bit. So we know that these NLT phonons, and their energy is given by the number of electron hole pairs times their bias voltage. The number of electron hole pairs generated by an interaction is given by the electron recoil energy divided by epsilon, where epsilon here in a is the amount of energy that's required in a given substrate to create an electron hole pair. So in germanium, that's 3 eV. So then the total phonon energy is given by the recoil energy plus E times your voltage bias times your number of electron hole pairs. So nuclear recoils produce electron hole pairs less efficiently than electron recoils. And so in that case, you take into account, you have to take into account the yield for an electron recoil. So the total energy then can be written as ER times 1 plus your yield times E times your voltage bias divided by epsilon. So if we calibrate the detectors then using an electron recoil, the resulting energy scale is what we call KeVEE, electron equivalent. And if we want to convert that to KeVNR, right, to take into account this inefficiency that you have here, if you want to go between them, you use this formula, where this yield is 1 for an electron recoil event. And so, just rewriting this in a concise way. All right, so that might leave you to think, how is it then that I figure out what this yield term is, right? That's the important part in all of this. And so you either need to measure it directly or you need to model it. The most utilized form or model that's used for this is called the Lindhard. It comes from Lindhard theory. So there's a whole paper on it. It's equal to this formula. There's nothing special about it. The other way is that you try to just measure it by doing dedicated measurements in small experiments. So I think I already did this. So. What I wanted to do was show you this picture here. So this is just going to demonstrate for you the difference between KeVEE and KeVNR. Okay, so you have the ionization energy in KeVEE versus the recoil energy in KeVER. So if you have, in this example here, so we have up here, this is from a calibration source. So this is an electron calibration source or a calibration source for electron recoils. So it's really gammas. This here is a calibration source for nuclear recoils and where you would see it on this ratio line. This here in the circle is the 10.4 keV line for an electron recoil. And so here you can see it in the electron recoil equivalent right where it's supposed to be. But if you want to view it in these KeVNR sort of units, you see that it actually is around 16 keV in nuclear recoil units. So just trying to demonstrate visually what this might look like or how you see it. All right, so I'll promise to walk away from that and not give you more gory details about some of the physics that's in the detectors themselves. So Super CDMS at Snow Lab, it's this second generation detector. I just wanted to kind of show this. This is an engineering schematic, but basically this is the detector with its readout stem. This is the dilution refrigerator. This is that radon controlled clean room I was talking about. And then there's like a whole hallway that is essentially the cryogenics plant and the radon filter plant that supports it. Super CDMS like many of these detectors, it actually is kind of neat because it really covers a lot of space. So traditional nuclear recoil, ISIP background free, is sensitive to dark matter greater than 5 GeV. You can do a lower threshold nuclear recoil analysis with the ISIP detectors. You have limited discrimination in this case, so you kind of give up that nuclear recoil versus electron recoil discrimination, but you can get down to almost a GeV with that. In the high voltage mode, you give up discrimination completely, but you can get, you know, down to like maybe 300 KeV. No, sorry, MeV. I went one decade of energy too low. You can do electron recoils. You can do absorption, like dark photons, ALPs. These are all sort of the sorts of things that the Super CDMS has ambitions of trying to do with these detectors. Of course, they are not the only experiment. I should say also the Edelweiss experiment runs very similar to the Super CDMS program, so I'm not going to go into detail. The difference between the two primarily is that Edelweiss uses those NTD sensors that you glue onto the detectors, but they work similarly the same way. CREST is a little bit different. It still is using crystals. It's still reading out phonons using TSs, but instead of measuring ionization, they measure light yield. And so the cool thing with these experiments is that if I take a look again at that yield versus energy plot, so you can see your backgrounds from electron recoils are up here, and these are your nuclear recoil bands. And you can see that essentially they can tell the difference between an interaction that happens with an oxygen nucleus versus one that might happen on their tungsten nucleus. They have produced some very impressive low mass results that, you know, are world leading in some areas. And they have really extended their reach with their most recent detectors. And so I think that's sort of what I'll say here. So this, again, is your cross-section versus your mass. And then this is where that coherent neutrino scattering, this is sort of that floor of neutrinos from the sun that you worry about. They have plans to do an upgrade. So they have recently done this run. So they're upgrading to do more channels. They want to do more modules. They're also looking at complementary detector materials that they could use, different types of target crystals. And their initial results from this are very promising. And so they're pushing their sensor development. So, you know, they've taken some science data. They're doing upgrades. Like, the work here is really great, and they're making awesome progress.
Why do you think it's so far down in energy compared to everybody else?
Part of it has to do with the crystal that they choose. And so if you can think about the types of targets that are in their crystals, and you think about their atomic mass versus the atomic mass of like germanium, I think immediately understand from just a simple kinematic argument why they would be sensitive to something a little bit lower in energy. Yeah.
Can I go back to the previous slide, please?
Yes.
Is it like spin-independent cross-section?
Yeah, this is a spin-independent cross-section. Sorry, I should have said that.
Okay, so the region on the top of the graph is excluded by the...
So in these plots, the regions that are excluded are above...
Yeah.
Like this is the excluded region. It's always above and kind of to the right. Does that make sense? And so these are just all different kinds of results. And so you could imagine here that probably you could have a whole nother week of lectures if you wanted on different types of models. So talking about how like a lot of these detectors are now, you know, looking at the Migdol effect. And I could, if you wanted to do a Migdol effect analysis, I have the perfect person who could come in and ad nauseum tell you about all the details and flaws in some of the original papers and stuff like this. This is something like people are really working at, like these different, even different ideas that people have about the physics to do the types of detections. It's it's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, even like yesterday also we saw some bounce on the spin independent cross section. Like I couldn't see anything about the spin dependent.
Yeah, I did not. I don't think I've included in this talk any spin dependent results. Primarily because, I mean, the first day I talked about, you know, sort of the different assumptions that you can make in making an interpretation. But often when we're talking about results, I guess most often we'll use just a spin-independent case because it's simplest and it works for more people and more different types of experiments. And then secondarily, you'll see spin-dependent results as well because some of the technologies I've shown, like the PICO collaboration, and their target is like probably, you know, the best or amongst the best for doing spin-dependent analyses or interpretations. Maybe that's the way to say it. A spin-dependent interpretation that's currently running. It's important. Like, a lot of times I think we don't go and show every single plot for every single model that could be out there because at this point, like, all you're really doing is trying to say who's the best. Who's the best at seeing something that we don't see under certain assumptions. But it's important that we do have detectors that can cover different types of ideas and different types of interactions. Because once somebody sees something, then we'll know exactly what type of detectors we need to be working on building next, right? So I hope the fact that I kind of use this convention doesn't say that spin dependent or doing work with targets that might be sensitive in that area isn't important. It actually turns out to be kind of really important, and having the bubble chambers, I think, especially if we start thinking about different types of effective field theories that can come into play. If you check out one of those papers I had on Monday, you'll see in there there are plots that are showing for the different types of targets. So kind of generally they look at, I think, germanium, silicon, xenon, and fluorine, and I think they keep iodide in there as well. You'll see that depending on which operators are most important depends on which target is more favorable for the interaction. Which it probably makes a case that we keep some sodium iodide experiments in the mix as well, even if they're not actually seeing dark matter. But maybe one that holds open data sets.
Sure. Thank you.
Any other questions? So great. All right, so I want to spend the last part of today just talking a little bit about like where some of these technologies are going and kind of exploring a little bit in the future. So I know I didn't go into the theory behind electron recoiling dark matter or behind why light mass dark matter would be interesting. But I just kind of picked a starting point that I thought was accessible, would be accessible for everyone, and assume that from there, hopefully you would build off what interests you most. I think it's important to talk a little bit about some of the upcoming technologies because there are a lot of the theory work being done right now is being done at this lower mass dark matter models, and I think it's important just to have a quick overview of like where we are from an experimental or technology standpoint with some of those types of experiments. Thank you. All right, so let me just throw this all up here. So this is just, you know, a generic band diagram for silicon. And so the idea here is that the ultimate goal is, what is the smallest thing, like what is the smallest measurement you can make in any of these detectors? Like the smallest thing you can hope to measure is a single electron hole, like, right? A single electron hole pair, you can't measure anything smaller than that, right? Because we can't take an electron and divide it in half. So with these technologies, that's like ultimately what's physically going to limit you. So how do we get down to the ability to be able to do that? Semiconductors are one area that people are looking into. So you can have electron excitation momentum and energy it scales in semiconductors and it can be exploited for these light matter, light dark matter searches. So in silicon, the band gap is 1.2 EV. Essentially, for that to happen, you need a phonon to, transition to happen. So this is a temperature dependent sort of effect. In silicon, the average energy needed to create an electron hole pair is 3.6 eV. It's also temperature dependent. So essentially, you know, looking at these numbers, what you come to realize is that you could be sensitive to energy deposits on the order of an EV, which is electron scattering, to sort of 10 EV, which is nuclear scattering, in these types of materials. But once you start to go looking at these types of materials, you're actually starting to enter the realm of solid state physics a little bit more than particle physics. And so let me just sort of talk about this. So, you know, if we want to do sort of a comparison, like in particle physics, we're thinking about energies that are typically greater than a keV, right? But in solid state physics, you're often thinking about temperatures that are less than 30 eV, energies less than 30 eV. In particle physics, you treat your systems and you do your calculations like you just have free particles, right? But you can't do that in solid state physics. You have to actually take like multi-body systems into account in a much more serious way. You know, particle physics, you know, great. Energy is equal to momentum squared over 2 times your mass, right? In solid state physics, allowed energies and momenta are given by dispersion relations. In particle physics, we have particles, they have masses, it's all well defined. We all carry the particle data guide around in our pocketbook, right? I guess now you hold it on your phone, handheld device, but I still like the miniature particle book. But in solid state physics, particles might have an effective mass rather than a truly defined mass. It's more of an effective mass. And so it means that that our thinking changes a little bit, and the types of physics and the knowledge we have changes a little bit. And it introduces some new challenges when you're trying to build a detector. And so the first challenge is in detector response. So when you start looking at things that are really low energy here, the details of the band structure become increasingly important. And so you need sort of a PDF to get the number of electron hole pairs that are given. I don't even know what that sentence means. It really doesn't make sense. But you do need a PDF in order for you to calculate essentially the number of electron hole pairs that you're going to get given any sort of energy deposit. So you end up have a probability of the number of electron holes that's dependent upon, or that is a probability function of both the number of electron hole pairs and the energy that's deposited. So that means you need to take into account something called Fano statistics. So these are dispersion probabilities. If you're thinking about a nuclear recoil, on top of that, you still have to think about quenching. Ionization yield is going to be less than 1. And when you go to these really, really low energies, they're not well defined or well measured. This is just an example here. This is a nuclear recoil energy. Going to lower and lower energies. This is the Linhart theory that is like what everybody uses in the Bible. This is an empirical yield that's given. And these green dots here are showing what Domek had measured in some data that they took. And so what you can see is, right, like it challenges sort of some of the ideas and thoughts that work at a higher range. I mean, I would say I compare it in my head much in the way, like in particle physics, like if you're doing classical mechanics versus then when you took third semester physics and it was all about like special relativity and like everything changed, right? And so it's that kind of change that's going on. The other thing that you have to think about is crystal impurities. They can lead to either partial energy deposits. If that happens, you know, you can get events that are between your quantization peaks, because ultimately what you're trying to do here is, you know, it's the idea that, you know, that you have quantization of the phonons going on. Like, that's what you want to see. You want to see peaks at one electron hole pair, another peak for two electron hole pairs, and another peak. And you want at three electron hole pairs, and et cetera. And what you want is you want that to be really clean peaks. You don't want a background, like a flat background of anything, that drowns those peaks out. Like, you want them very nice and clear. And so you worry about impact ionization. You worry about trapping. You worry about, you know, sub-band gap infrared radiation. All of these things can cause energy deposits that aren't quantized. You also have some special challenges when it comes to backgrounds. We need spectral information about radioactive decays at the EV scale. That doesn't exist, right? We haven't worked really in that realm before. How relevant this is really depends upon your exposure. If you're doing a short exposure, then your radioactive background is not as important. But if you end up doing longer exposures, then that could become important. But for sure, infrared and optical photons are significant backgrounds that people have challenges with right now trying to mitigate. Dark current leakage becomes significant and dominates also at the lowest backgrounds. And so these are the two sort of dominant backgrounds that people are working hard on right now. And I suspect this could be the more relevant background in the future once you figure out how to mitigate these. That's my speculation, though. The detectors. So this is actually, you know, there's a number of papers now out on these types of detectors that you can go and look at. But, I mean, this to me is the coolest thing ever. Like, you're literally seeing the quantization here of these electron hole pairs in this data. These devices, they will have sensitivity to a variety of sub-GeV dark matter models, and they only need sort of gram day exposures to make significant progress at this point, because the field is so new. You know, the sky's the limit sort of with smaller exposures. So you can make a big impact, but you gotta get over the technology challenges. That's the harder part. And so this is just talking a little bit about some of the characteristics, you know, that was done to demonstrate at a surface facility this very first detector doing these single electron hole pairs. And this type of work, like, this is like the first kind of results that came out. Since then, there's been a lot of activity, people trying different substrates, people trying different detector designs. This is the direction that Super CDMS and the Edelweiss detector programs are going in. So Edelweiss also has their own detectors that are trying to do this very low background, go for these very, very light dark matter particles. And so I just want to show you some results from their detector so you can see, you kind of can see the difference here between an NTD, what they're able to do with their NTDs sensors versus the TES sensors. But again, this is sort of their data. So this is what they'd expect their one electron to look like, two electrons, three, four, and five. So, you know, here there's still a bit of work to do to understand exactly what is going on, you know, with their data, but they're making progress too. So, as promised, I would end a little bit early so you could get to the thing. This kind of wraps up my dark matter lectures. I am convinced that the next decade is going to be exciting for dark matter and for direct detection. With the various G2 experiments, are coming online. So several of them, most of them are online already, but there are several that are still coming online, including SuperCDMS. So they will cover a lot of new parameter space. There's also, I just want to state that the WIMPs remain very interesting dark matter candidates, and other scenarios are great, gaining traction in the theoretical community. Well, ideas for direct searches, new ideas for these direct searches that can probe this new parameter space are gaining a lot of momentum. There are a lot of ideas out there. I was even having discussion at lunch today with somebody from Perimeter Institute, and we were trying to figure out, there was a group in Israel that was trying to use color centers to do this very light dark matter detection, and we were kind of wondering what, trying to understand the physics of what that looks like and understand if those detectors had gained any traction. But that's sort of like using a quantum sensor in some ways. So there's a lot of like wild ideas out there for the technology too. And I just highlighted a few. There's a number. Anyway, so given the wealth of given the wealth of theoretical ideas, the diversity of experiments that are out there, and the diversity of targets that we have, I think, there's a good chance if there's a signal out there, hopefully we have the tools to see it. So that's what I have for today. Tomorrow we'll do some stuff with neutrinos. Thank you.